In the late 90s, 98, 99, there was a group, really large group, of refugees that came in to the States. This was really not an ordinary group of refugees, but it was a pretty big wave. They were all, for the most, they're not all, but for the most part, they were all really young men from Sudan. A lot of them were brought in through Lutheran Immigration and Relief Services, working with Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities helped. A lot of them came in. Now these boys out of Sudan, they were called the Lost Boys for various reasons by the media. These were boys who ended up being the victims of the civil war in Sudan between the northern forces and the southern forces in Sudan. And the northern forces would come into a village and sort of raid it and either conscript or kill the older men in the villages. And the women were either kidnapped or murdered as well. They would come three times, and it was on the third time they knew that things were coming, that the families, knowing that things were imminent, they would send these young boys out. They didn't want them to be conscripted and brainwashed and brought into the midst of this horrible situation. And you literally had a biblically sized exodus out of Sudan. You could just see whole streams of these young boys going out. There were a few young women in the midst of that, but not very many. Families figured they were better off on their own in the wilderness than being killed or conscripted by the forces in the Civil War. These young men wandered. Some of them, in order to assuage their hunger, would eat mud, leaves off of trees, just something to fill their bellies and make them feel like they had eaten something. They left Sudan and ended up in Ethiopia. Bad news. Ethiopia then has a famine and they get kicked out. So they try to go back into Sudan and they're forced out now by the military forces. And they end up in Kenya. They have all of these stories about crossing the River Gilo, where they had military forces behind them shooting at them, forcing them to cross the river, which was infested with crocodiles. Get shot or get eaten, that was their choice. They eventually land in Kenya. And as they are there in Kenya, they begin to form one of the largest refugee camps in Kakuma. Massive, massive refugee camp. And it's all young boys, no elders. They've found their own way. They've managed to survive the animals and the wildlife and the bullets and the crux, and then here they all land together. And the world governments realize that this is a major problem. And so they seek to find homes for them. And as I said, the Catholic Charities, the Lutheran Immigration and Relief Services, and lots of groups work now to relocate them. When I was an intern, I worked with the church that had done just that. They had a community of about 30 boys who were there in that town. They had arrived about a year before. The old parsonage had been turned into a resettlement house. There was a dozen living there, and then various members living throughout the community. And there was a consistent theme that as they left, they got on that plane in Kenya and landed in Boston in the middle of winter. there was a great and complete reorientation that was necessary. Because you've gone from a camp that is essentially 1,000 years in time, in some ways, before them. It's dirt. It's whatever shelter they can build and form. Sometimes lacking basic necessities. They go through their screening process, they get on the plane, and they land in a technological marvel. They land in Boston. As they're driving, my supervising pastor had 4 of them staying in his house. He was their foster parent. They had a foster family now. 4 of their own kids, 4 Sudanese refugees. And as they were driving out of the airport, some tall grass was, decorative grass was on the road, and they said, "Are there lions?" Some of the Catholic Charities had relocated a handful of young men who were over 18. All the ones the congregation dealt with were under 18. The Catholic Charities had resettled those who were over 18 into an apartment, and they just sort of dropped them off, and they were there. They set them up in the apartment and then try to explain to these young men how a can opener works. We take it for granted. How to use a stove to cook the things that are in the cans. Microwaves. They had to have a complete and utter orientation shift in their perspective, in their worldview. Everything changed for them. It was in a very real way, an entirely new identity. And for the most part, they thrived and did fantastic. Last week, we talked about Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he hammers home his authority to proclaim a gospel that is completely and utterly free of obstacles and obligations. Today we get a summary for him of why this is so important. Why he stood by his authority to proclaim this message. Because he wants to make it very clear that there is a complete and utter orientation shift needed in our perspective as we are brought into this people of God. It is even perhaps greater than what the refugees needed. The law is not what saves us. Paul wants to make that very clear. Not ceremony, not tradition, not law, not obligations, not rules. "For through the law I died to the law," he says. The law serves one purpose and one purpose only, to constrain and contain and force us to recognize that we cannot do it. We cannot be made righteous through the use of the law. The law shows us the reality. It is, as I tell the confirmation students, a mirror. It's not a list of rules for us. I mean, it is a list of rules, but it's a list of rules that are so completely impossible to follow, it shows us how broken we are. That we don't live in the correct relationships that God has established for us. It shows us the power of sin in the world and how we cannot save ourselves. That law, in its mirror effect, kills us. For through the law, I have died to the law. That's its purpose. It kills us so that we may be driven to Christ. We can't trust in our own works. We can't trust that if we follow these rules, we're set. Our perspective must shift. I have been crucified with Christ. And it is no longer I who live, but it is Christ who lives in me. This is what Paul wants to make clear is the new vision of our lives as the people of God. It's not our efforts. It's not how well we maintain the law, we keep the traditions, that we follow the rules. It is only whether or not we are united with Christ. Because if we are united with Christ, what he is, we become. This is not some mere symbolic connection, not just a declaration that doesn't really have teeth. This is a statement about how Christ now becomes part of us. The law doesn't set us apart as the people of God. Christ sets us apart as the people of God because it is Christ who dwells in us. One of the early church theologians says that Christ becomes man so that man may become godlike. There is a movement here. Christ comes to us and exchanges his glory for our human self, our human nature. And in so doing, allows it so that our fallen human nature may be exchanged for a true human nature. The idea of exchange, Luther loved. That Christ takes upon all of our sin and gives us all his righteousness. Christ becomes united with us. We become brought into a divine life. Not a human life of following rules and regulations, but a life in which we are made to be more and more like God. More and more we are remolded into Christ's image. Then, I know what some folks would say, it sounds like you're trying to get rid of the rules and the regulations. That you're just sort of creating a license to allow things to happen. And folks say, hey, I can do whatever I want because now Christ lives in me. Well, there's where we still continue to realize that we are same time sinner saints. Simul justus et peccator. We're not finished being perfected yet. But we do begin to see signs of it. We see signs of it precisely when we behave as Christ behaves. When we practice with one another, as we exchange forgiveness with one another, as we lead grace-filled lives. Because that's Christ's nature that has come to dwell in us. Insofar as we live that out, of course, we live that out by living out the perfection of the commandments. We continue to be made holy, to look like God. We never really ultimately reach it in this life. But it will be completed when Christ returns. But this life is all about growing in righteousness, Christ dwelling in us. We are united, Paul says in Romans, with Christ in the waters of baptism. We are united to his death. So that we know, as he died and rose again, we will die and rise again as well. For Christ lives in us. There's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live, I live in the flesh. I live by faith in the Son of God who loves me and gave himself for me. This is Christ's exchange. His love poured out for us, that we may be made one in the people of God. Not to have the law as our distinguishing mark, but to have his very life and existence within us. It's a radical reorientation for us. We want to save ourselves. We want to tell everyone, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Take care. Do it yourself. And we fail to see the reality out there that we cannot do it. This past week, we had a family come in looking for help. They had driven in from a neighboring state. They had been here for 3 days, husband, wife, 4 kids, from age 11 down to 1. They had come, the wife said, for the reading of a will of her grandmother's. And it didn't go. She didn't get the money that she was told she was going to get because her father was contesting the brokenness of the world is crazy. But they had spent 3 nights in their van. And they had come in. No. The mother had come in holding the one-year-old on her shoulder, saying that they hadn't really eaten. They were out of money. And they needed to just go back to Ohio. I said, fine. And then she said, my husband won't come in to get help. I said, fine. I had her sit down with the sleeping one-year-old. I walked over to Eaton Park, got them some gift cards so they could go over and have a meal. And on the way back, I was fuming that a father who had children who were hungry wouldn't do what was needed to get help. I said, this is one of the reasons that pride is still one of the 7 deadlies. We want to make it our own. We want to make it on our own. We want to do it by ourselves. We don't want help. It continues to show us that we're stuck. Because when we believe that we have to do it on our own, whether it's in life, whether it's with God, we lose. The law shows us precisely in its good role that we need help. We cannot do it on our own. The idea that we have to do it on our own, that we can't take any help, is wrong. Pray fervently for that mother, giving thanks that she, knowing she needed help, came and got it. It's demoralizing. It makes us feel full of shame because we haven't been the people that we thought we could be. That's what God says to us. Yeah, you're not the people I made. But I'm going to forgive you anyway. I'm going to give you the gift of my Son, and he will dwell in you. And you will be my people. We need a new vision. We need to make sure we hear Paul's vision, that we are not saved by our works, that we are, in fact, saved as the people of God within whom Christ dwells. This Christ who came to us, who came for us, who reached out to us in the waters of baptism, and who continues to reach out today in the sacrament, continually giving of himself so that we may continue to be formed into his image, made into his nature, and that we get to make him known through our very lives. Thanks be to God.